health issue, care topics. Her interests are on issues related to medical ethics, the nature of medical evidence, and health care policy and the public interest. Her recent book, which was entitled The Truth About Drug Companies, has been acclaimed as a clear, courageous, and research-based analysis of the role of the pharmaceutical industry in the USA today. I think that the extent of her public policy contributions is attested to by the fact that Time magazine named her as one of the 25 most influential Americans. Dr. Angel is a graduate of the Boston University School of Medicine, and she's trained both in internal medicine and in anatomic pathology. She served at the New England Journal of Medicine for many years, becoming executive editor in 1988 and editor-in-chief in 1999. She has received very many honors for her work, not surprisingly, and she's now in the Department of Social Medicine at Harvard Medical School. The title of her talk tonight, as you know, is Healthcare, A Tale of Two Countries. And I'd like you to join me in welcoming an outstanding, outspoken, and fearless individual who tells it like it is, Dr. Marcia Angel.
Thank you, Dr. Baird. I'm really delighted to be here in Canada, a country that I have come to admire greatly over my professional life. The relationship between our two countries has been the subject of quite a bit of attention over the last week in honor of President Obama's visit to Ottawa. In fact, the New York Times on Wednesday had a full-page ad by an institution called the Canadian American Business Council, full-page ad, with fulsome celebration of the friendship between our two countries. For example, it includes this quote from President Kennedy years ago. "Geography has made us neighbors," Kennedy said. "History has made us friends. Economics has made us partners, and necessity has made us allies. Those whom nature hath so joined together, let no man put asunder." Close quotes. Now, this is fulsome and inspiring stuff, and there's a little bit of truth in there, as excessive as it sounds. But there are still great differences between our two countries, and an important one is the way we provide health care to our citizens. In recent years, that difference has become somewhat less stark than it once was. There are now efforts underway in your country to make your health system more like ours, in particular, to permit the sale of private insurance to cover the same services as Medicare, and to allow doctors and hospitals to be paid by both Medicare and private payers. In short, to open your system to the market. Very few Canadians advocate privatizing Medicare entirely, just partially. Let me interrupt myself to say, is this making a funny noise? Is there? Okay, there's okay. Now, is this okay now? Yes. All right. There were two microphones on and they were doing something to each other. Anyway, very few Canadians do advocate completely privatizing your system, but they do partially. The argument is that partial privatization would introduce the efficiencies of the private sector, shorten waiting times, and reduce costs to the public purse. In my talk this evening, I'll explain why none of that is true. why, in fact, your system, if privatized, would become less efficient, not more. Waiting times would probably grow, not shrink, and the cost to the public would rise, not fall. To make my case, I'll have to spend some time describing the U.S. health system. I realize that's a daunting prospect for any audience, given how Byzantine our system is, so I'll try to make that part of my talk as brief and painless as possible. But I'm afraid it must be done in order for you to better understand what's at stake for you here in Canada. Now, I'm thinking I should switch the microphones again. Okay. Why don't I just take this one off? And it's... Okay. Just take this one off altogether. Is this one off now? Okay. All right. Raise your hand if there are any problems. If you can't hear me or if it's squawking, let me know. But first I want to, before I go through the U.S. healthcare system, a little history. In 1972, UConn became the last jurisdiction to adopt the Medical Care Act, which set up a system, Medicare, your Medicare, to provide acute hospital and physician care to all Canadians. Until then, the Canadian and U.S. health systems were much the same. Both were partly public, partly private, partly for-profit, partly not-for-profit. Both also left a great many people uninsured. Costs were also about the same, a little over $300 per person in 1970, in American dollars. Health outcomes were much the same, too. Life expectancy was slightly less in Canada at that time. But with the implementation of Canadian Medicare, the two systems began to diverge rapidly in all respects. The U.S. system became more and more costly, while leaving increasing numbers of Americans uninsured. By 2005, the most recent year for which I have statistics, costs were over twice as high in the United States as in Canada, over twice as high. Nearly $7,000 per person in the United States, compared with $3,300 per person in Canada. These are all in American dollars. And that gap is growing. Yet, while Canada now insures all its population for necessary doctor and hospital care, the U.S. leaves 15% of its population without any insurance whatsoever. That's 46 million people without any insurance whatsoever, more than the total population of Canada. Furthermore, most other Americans are underinsured, in that we often need to pay a significant fraction of our medical bills out of pocket, and some necessary services may not be covered at all. In a recent survey, three times as many Americans as Canadians reported that they went without needed care because of costs. Even while costs skyrocketed in the U.S., health outcomes compared with Canada got worse and worse. Canadians now live, on average, 2.5 years longer than Americans. Infant mortality rates are lower in Canada. So is preventable mortality, which is defined as death before the age of 75 from diseases that could have been treated. What happened over the nearly four decades since the implementation of Canadian Medicare? Why are Americans spending so much more than Canadians and getting less? Some apologists for the U.S. system say that we really aren't getting less. We're getting more medical care, they say, but it's just not captured in population statistics like infant mortality or life expectancy. And we're getting more, they say, because we're a demanding sort of people. According to them, Americans insist on excessive medical care. Now, it is true that some Americans get much more of certain kinds of health care than Canadians, mainly expensive tests and procedures and specialist visits. But contrary to the image of Americans flocking to their doctors, we actually receive fewer basic medical services than Canadians. We have fewer hospital beds per person and fewer nurses per capita. We have slightly more doctors, but we see them less often, and we spend fewer days in the hospital. So no matter how demanding we Americans are said to be, we actually settle for rather little, not only in comparison with Canada, but in comparison with nearly every other advanced country as well. How can we explain the U.S. paradox of spending more and getting less? The only plausible explanation is that there is something about the American system itself, something about the way we finance and deliver health care that's enormously inefficient compared with Canada. And here it is. The underlying problem is that the U.S. alone among advanced countries relies primarily on private, largely investor-owned businesses to provide health care to its citizens. Alone among advanced countries, we treat health care like a market commodity instead of a social service. Thus, we distribute it not according to medical need, but according to the ability to pay. If you can afford health care or are well insured, you can have all you want. If you don't, if you aren't wealthy, if you can't afford good insurance, too bad. But there's a great mismatch between medical need and the ability to pay. In fact, those with the greatest need are precisely those least able to pay. So while markets are good for many things, they're not a good way to distribute health care because that's not their primary purpose. Businesses aim to increase revenues and maximize profits. That's what they do. Hospitals in the U.S., for example, market their services incessantly. Like all businesses, they want more, not fewer customers, but only if they can pay. People who are wealthy or well insured may get an MRI that they don't need, while those without insurance may not get one that they do need. Now, this doesn't make sense in lots of ways. For one thing, you would think a healthcare system would be more attached to providing healthcare, and instead of this sort of approximate targeting of healthcare needs. So it doesn't make sense in a lot of ways. But one way it doesn't make sense is that even in economic terms, it's irrational. Here we are with an unaffordable health system, and everyone, even the most fervent capitalist, acknowledges that we need to control costs. But at the same time, we've left health care to the market, which by its very nature is always pushing to expand. Now, does that make sense? Let's look more closely at how the American healthcare market works. Now is when I'm going to have to ask you to bear with me while I describe this system a little bit. The first thing to understand is that this is not a system at all. It's a non-system with thousands of separate parts operating more or less independently of one another. Most Americans under age 65 receive health care through their employers. Employers select insurance plans, and they pay a portion of the premiums, these days less and less, a smaller and smaller portion. But not all employers offer health insurance. It's strictly voluntary. They don't have to do that. And when they do, the benefits may not be comprehensive. They may cover some services, but not others. Moreover, employers now are increasingly capping their contributions. They pay a set amount toward the premium, but no more, even when the premium rises. By capping their contributions, then, employers ensure that the burden of increasing costs falls entirely on the worker. Workers, in turn, often turn down health insurance even when it's offered because they can't afford to pay their growing share of the premiums. The employment-based system, then, is coming apart, and each year it covers a smaller and smaller percentage of Americans. So now let's look at the insurance companies with whom employers contract to provide care. These are mostly investor-owned, for-profit businesses. They try to keep their premiums somewhat in check in order to compete for employers' business with the other insurance companies, but they also want to maximize profits. They've discovered that the surest way to do that is to shortchange patients on medical services, to stint on medical services. The less care they provide, the more profitable they are. In fact, the insurance industry refers explicitly to their medical costs as their, quote, medical loss ratio. And they boast to potential investors about how low it is, and it is low. As it turns out, the best way for insurers to keep costs down is by not insuring high-risk people at all. For example, people with chronic diseases like diabetes. Or by limiting the benefit package of those they do insure. For example, by excluding expensive services like bone marrow transplantation. Or by passing costs back to patients as high deductibles and co-payments and claim denials and general hassle. That's how they compete. The U.S. is the only country in the world with a health care system actually based on dodging sick people. The idea is to saddle someone else with the sick people. These practices add enormously to overhead because they require a great deal of paperwork. They're playing a game of hot potato, and that takes a lot of paperwork. They also require creative marketing to attract the affluent and healthy and avoid the poor and sick. Not surprisingly, the U.S. has by far the highest overhead costs in the world, roughly a third of total health expenditures. Now, let's follow the healthcare dollar as it wends its way from employers toward the doctors and nurses and hospitals that actually provide the care. First, private insurers regularly skim off the top a substantial fraction of the premiums, on average about 15 to 25%. Remember that figure, 15 to 25% right off the top of the healthcare dollar for their administrative costs, marketing, and profits. Compare that with the 1 to 2% overhead for Canada's Medicare. The remainder is then passed along a veritable gauntlet of satellite businesses that have sprung up around the healthcare industry. These include brokers to cut deals, disease management and utilization review companies, drug management companies, legal services, marketing consultants, billing agencies, information management firms, and so on and so on and so on. They, too, siphon off some of the premiums, including enough for their administrative costs, marketing, and profits. The most popular part of the U.S. health system is the government-administered program for Americans over age 65, also called Medicare, like the Canadian system. This is a single-payer program embedded within our private market-based system. It's by far the most efficient part of our system, with overhead costs to the government of about 2%, same as Canadian Medicare, and it covers virtually everyone over the age of 65, not just some of them. It also covers everyone for the full package of benefits, so it can't be tailored to avoid high-risk patients like the private plans. But U.S. Medicare is not perfect, and it's been weakened by the Bush administration, which was hostile to all government programs except war. Moreover,
Moreover, because Medicare is embedded in our market-based system, it experiences many of the same inflationary forces, including having to deal with profit-maximizing hospitals and physicians groups. In addition, doctors' fees are skewed to reward highly paid specialists for doing as many expensive procedures as possible. As a result, Medicare inflation is almost as high as inflation in the private sector. In the past, there have been many attempts to reform the American system incrementally. Mainly, these have been efforts to counteract the harshest effects of the market by subsidizing care to people who would otherwise go without, and to discourage demand by various stratagems. But all attempts to reform the system piecemeal have run into the following dilemma. If we expand coverage, costs will inevitably rise. On the other hand, if costs are controlled, then coverage inevitably shrinks. Think about that. If we don't change the system, if it stays essentially as it is, and we merely tinker around the edges and we try to expand coverage, for example, recently by expanding coverage to children, then it's got to cost more. The only way to expand coverage while controlling costs is to change the system entirely. Our two major political parties have embraced opposite horns of this dilemma. Generally, the Republicans are willing to reduce coverage to control costs, while the Democrats and President Obama want to put more money into the system to expand coverage. Of the two, I prefer the Democrats' approach, but it isn't sustainable, since it leaves the current dysfunctional and disastrously inflationary system in place. It can't go on for very long. Polls consistently show that about two-thirds of Americans would prefer a Canadian-type system, as would about 60% of doctors now. They lagged for a while, but now they're up there too. Now, if that were a presidential election, it would be a landslide, two-thirds, 60%. So what's stopping us? Why don't we do it? Who benefits from the current system? The answer is the many businesses that profit from the healthcare dollar, mainly the private insurance industry and for-profit facilities. They, in turn, have inordinate influence over lawmakers and many economists and health policy experts who propagate the myth that a national health system is somehow unrealistic. In addition, many procedure-oriented specialists are quite happy with the current system. Primary care physicians in the United States actually earn on average less than they do in Canada. And they're becoming something of an endangered species in the United States. But many specialists are paid very much more than they are in Canada. And that predisposes them to exaggerate the failings of the Canadian system and minimize those of the American system. In the US, average physician income means nothing because the extremes are so great. So much for the American system. With that as background, what about Canada? What are the failings of your system? Let's go back to 1972, when the Yukon Territory signed on. Everyone was insured for physician and hospital services, but not for other health needs, such as home care or prescription drugs. Other benefits were left to the provinces. Moreover, many hospitals at that time added user fees, and doctors added extra charges. This ended with the 1984 Canada Health Act, which required that health care be accessible to everyone and essentially abolished user fees and extra charges. The system was able to keep costs in check and keep them quite low, in part by controlling the supply of certain services, for example, imaging and surgery facilities, and the specialist positions necessary to carry out the procedures. The result was the growth of waiting lists for some procedures. Nevertheless, Canadian Medicare remained popular with the public and still is fairly popular. During the 1990s, however, as Canada went through an economic downturn, hadn't seen anything then, Canadian Medicare was underfunded. Waiting lists became a political issue, and public satisfaction with the system, while still high, began to fall. Toward the end of the 1990s, as economic conditions started to improve and the publicity about waiting lists increased, the provinces began to put more money into the health system. Waits are now somewhat shorter than they were in the 1990s, and public satisfaction is higher. But waits are still too long for certain elective procedures like hip and knee replacements, and it takes time for the increased funding to be translated into more facilities and specialists. The waiting times are the ostensible reason for the pressures to partially privatize the Canadian health system. I say ostensible because I believe the main reason has to do with the desire of businesses and some specialists to profit from the system, just as they do in the United States. But couching the issue in terms of waiting time sounds more public-spirited. In 2005, the Canadian Supreme Court handed down its decision in Chauly v. Quebec. It held that a one-year wait for a hip replacement violated human rights guaranteed by the province of Quebec. Either Quebec would have to shorten waiting times or permit the procedure to be done privately. Although the effect in Quebec itself has been quite limited, the decision added force to a strong move throughout Canada, particularly right here in BC and Alberta, to permit the marketing of private insurance and the delivery of care in for-profit facilities by doctors working in both the public and private systems simultaneously. These facilities and doctors would be able to bill Medicare, but could also add extra charges. Whether this would shorten waiting times by creating more facilities is arguable. What it would certainly do is change who would do the waiting. In the United States, for example, well-insured patients have a very short wait for a hip replacement, but the 46 million Americans without any health insurance might wait for the rest of their lives. As in all such parallel systems, privatization would draw off resources from the public system, both physicians and other assets. Doctors working in both systems would have an incentive to divert wealthier patients to the private one. Yes, waiting times would be shorter in the private system, but they would almost certainly grow longer in the public system. Access would come to be more about money than medical need, just as it is in the United States. Moreover, it would not be a zero-sum game, and this is important. Money diverted to the private system would not buy the same amount of health care as it would in the public system. There have been many studies comparing for-profit with not-for-profit health care in the United States. For-profit care is nearly always more expensive and usually of lower quality. These studies are consistent. You just don't get as much health care for the dollar from for-profit businesses. Indeed, logic and common sense would suggest the same conclusions even without the growing evidence. Unless we believe, without any data whatsoever, that for-profit organizations have some secret of efficient operation not known to the nonprofits, it makes no sense to suppose that given the same payment system and the same patient population, the for-profit healthcare organizations can provide similar services while extracting their profits and business costs from the system. Neither does it make any sense to imagine that investor-owned businesses are charitable organizations that wish to contribute their resources to the community. It's obvious that their responsibilities to their investors require them to take profits from the community. To do this, as many U.S. studies have shown, they skim off the profitable patients and the profitable services, leaving the leftovers to the nonprofits. Canadian advocates of privatization often suggest that waiting times for hip replacement in the U.S. are short because of our market-based system. But that's not the case. In the U.S., most hip replacements are done in our public system for the elderly, our Medicare. So if we compare waiting times between the two countries, we're not comparing public and private systems. We're comparing two public systems, one of which is better funded. I would urge you, Canadians, not to be swayed by the siren song of the privatizers. This is about greed and profiteering, not about better health care. The very same businesses that have made an exorbitantly expensive and unhealthy mess of the American system stand ready to do the same for you. The problem with Canadian Medicare is not the system, it's the amount of money you put into it. Our problem is exactly the opposite. It's not the money, it's the system. There's plenty of money already in it. There's another problem with privatizing Canada's Medicare. It's not a reversible experiment. NAFTA, the trade agreement with Canada, the U.S., and Mexico, stipulates that businesses may operate freely in all three countries. Canada's Medicare has been exempted because it isn't a business, but if the system became significantly privatized, the giant U.S. health firms will be free to move in, and that could not be undone. In sum, I believe Canada's Medicare is one of the best health systems in the world, far superior to the U.S. system. I would like to see it broaden its services to include long-term care, home care, and prescription drugs. And I believe it needs to be better funded, although it doesn't require anywhere near the amount of money we put into our system. But it fulfills its obligations to all Canadians to provide essential health care based on medical need, not the ability to pay. And it has the great communitarian value of requiring everyone to be a part of the system so that everyone has a stake in it. I very much hope that you will not privatize it even a little. If you let that camel's nose under the tent flap, you can count on overall costs rising and access declining. If you take nothing else away from this talk, I would like you to remember 3 points. 1, privatizing your system, even partially, will not enable the provincial governments to contain health costs. That's a fantasy. In fact, costs will rise because the public will end up subsidizing a grossly inefficient private system in addition to the public one. The only way to come out ahead, then, in that case, would be to starve the public system. 2, privatization is not a reversible experiment, as I said. Once you allow for-profit health businesses in, you can't get them out. In that sense, partial privatization is like being a little bit pregnant. And finally, the great, great strength of Canadian Medicare is the social compact that underlies it. Every Canadian, rich or poor, has equal access to its services. I believe it would be a grave mistake to break that compact. The wisest course for you is to expand and reinforce your public system, not undermine it. Canada should not be more like the United States. We should be more like you. Thank you.
Dr. Angel is going to take some questions. I would urge you to keep your questions focused, not to make them statements of belief or ramble on. So if you could keep your questions focused, we'll take some from the floor. Gentlemen, way at the back. I'm going to ask Dr. Angel to please repeat the questions. Yeah.
The gentleman says that many European countries have hybrid systems, and what is my opinion of that? Much is made of the fact that in some of the European countries there's a good deal of private health care, but it's tightly regulated. It's universal, or everyone gets health care in these countries, and within the private part of the system, the benefits are the same, the price is the same. You can't play the game of hot potato. You can't shunt somebody off. And it's still a fairly small part of the system. England has a parallel private system, but quite small. And everybody does pay into the public system, of course. I still would prefer to see the Canadian way, the way it originally was established, that everyone is in. Because I think that that has the wealthy people, the people of higher socioeconomic status then have a stake in it, and I think that's essential. Thank you. I told you I like Canada.
There's one over here.
Yes. Neither of those two things explain that. Oh, I'm sorry. The gentleman says that he believes that the costliness of the healthcare system has to do with new technologies and an aging population. There have been some studies of both of these things. The aging population, of course, does add to health costs, but not nearly as much as it's often said to. The United States, which has the most rapidly increasing health costs anywhere, actually has a younger population than Canada and Europe. It doesn't play much of a part. The technology is global, of course, and some technologies add to costs. Some technologies will decrease costs. Certain kinds of surgery now can be done much more cheaply. All countries have the same technologies. There are no secrets anymore. It's the deployment of the technologies. I would say in Canada, perhaps some of them are underdeployed. In the United States, there is way too much use of technology, particularly in for-profit freestanding facilities, radiology centers, imaging centers of various sorts. And they are used willy-nilly, whether they should be used or not, whether there's any medical reason for it or not, because it's very profitable to do so. So I think the use of technology does play a role in the United States.
And probably all over to some extent. But I don't think we'd want to give it up if it's used intelligently. She points out that she read that BC is spending 25% less on drugs than other provinces. I wasn't aware of that figure. It's been a while since I've looked at it, but British Columbia has had a history of having a very good regulatory policy for prescription drugs, and they're very careful about what drugs they pay for and what drugs they don't. And I applaud British Columbia in this way. Yes. Do I see a way that President Obama can politically overcome the factions that would be resisting a universal health system? No. So far, he has not shown the inclination to do that. Now, he is on record when he was a state senator in Illinois as favoring a single-payer healthcare system. He is backed away from that because he believes it's politically unrealistic. I think what he is grappling with now is there any way he can expand coverage and control costs at the same time? And he still believes that there's some magic bullet that will allow him to do that. There isn't. And I don't know what lessons he will draw when he finds that. Now, it happens that right now the U.S. is throwing about $1 trillion into the economy any old way it can. And the healthcare system can absorb a lot of that. And so he may say, well, right now, expanding coverage, even though it increases costs, is a good thing to do because you're getting money out the door. But he should not confuse this. People should not confuse the idea of stimulating the economy with the answer to the healthcare problem. Sooner or later, we'll want to have a sustainable healthcare system, and we can't do it that way. Yes, you had a... Your politicians or my politicians? Our politicians. Yes, but I was preaching to the choir. In Saskatchewan a couple of times, and these were single-payer folks. I did give a very similar talk to a combined meeting of the orthopedists of the United States and Canada in Quebec last June. And I would have thought that the orthopedists would be not particularly receptive because of the hip transplantation sort of deal. They are among those most eager to partially privatize. I was kind of surprised. They seem friendly, but... and you certainly don't want an orthopedist mad at you. So. But that's all. And then at home, of course, I speak quite a bit. Oh, it's a terrible situation. What do I see happening to county hospitals and public hospitals in the states as the states are coming up with budget deficits? You know, they can't run a deficit. I think there's only two states that can legally, so they must balance their budget, and that's why Obama plans to give a big portion of the stimulus package to the states to use for Medicaid and for things like public hospitals, but it's not going to be enough. And the states are cutting some essential services and staff at public hospitals and so forth. I think it's a disaster. Yes, go ahead.
I think maybe we'll
yes, we should probably go on. I think she made her point very eloquently, and we'll just move on. The question was, what role does litigation or the fear of litigation have in the cost issues I raise, particularly in the United States? That's a good question. No one knows quite what the influence is. There are many people who believe that tort reform, so that doctors would not run such a risk of malpractice suits, would be helpful. Because doctors often do, or are said to often do, extra tests and procedures to guard against any accusations of negligence in the court. And malpractice suits in general are a much bigger problem, I believe, in the United States than they are here, or the threat of them. If you look at the actual amount of money that is spent in the premiums for insurance against malpractice and the actual malpractice verdicts, it's a fairly small part of the healthcare dollar. I think it's, what, about 5%, something like that. But the argument is then made that you can't calculate the cost of defensive medicine, a doctor who does an x-ray that doesn't need to be done, because he's afraid of being sued. And, of course, there's no way. That's an imponderable. There's no way to measure that. I think it does play some role, but it's not the greatest part of the problem by any means. And I think it's often exaggerated. Well, sure, you do have to pay for it, and is it to put more money into Canadian Medicare? Is that a budget buster? People say, well, you would have to raise taxes, or you would have to decrease other services. And I think one of the problems with the federal contributions to the provinces is that it doesn't just go for health care. It's not earmarked. It goes for education and social services and so forth. And so it stands to reason that if you keep the amount of money the same or the tax rate the same and you have other responsibilities, that, yeah, there'll be some competition. The important thing is if everybody is in it together, they can make that decision as a country. Do we want to put more into healthcare or don't we? And, you know, I don't think taxes is the dirty word that a lot of people feel. It depends on how much and who you tax. But it seems to me to tax the wealthy a little bit more for something as precious as this, why not?
A gentleman back there with a mustache.
A gentleman with a mustache, okay. Yeah, it's true that in every advanced country, he said that how can you have a sustainable healthcare system anywhere, I think you're saying, if the cost goes up faster than the background inflation rate every year, which it does in every advanced country. Not as fast in the other countries as in Canada, but still it goes up faster than the background inflation rate. The Canadian system is a mixed system, as you know. I mean, the acute hospitalization and doctors paid for by the public system, but there is a big private system that I believe accounts for about 30% of expenditures. And some of that can have some of the inefficiencies of for-profit systems, although not that much. There's things like prescription drugs, which always a problem. But the important thing is to have a single payer system such that there is a publicly administered body that can oversee and manage the distribution of healthcare resources so that they make sense, so that they do target illnesses. And I think if that is done seriously, you probably would be able to keep it within a sustainable level. But if you can't, then you have a mechanism for some sort of rationing. You have a mechanism for saying, well, we can't offer this, or we can't offer something else in certain ages, or we can't offer more than, you know, three of these procedures. I don't think we're anywhere near that. I think if we had an efficient, rational system, we would not have to do that. But the point is in a universal single-payer system, you do have the mechanism for doing that. And if it's publicly administered, it's done for a reason other than to enrich some investors. With which? No, no.
Amy? Any more
I don't know. You mean in terms of this woman has a friend in the U.S. who says that if you eliminated all of the uninsured, which sounds a little harsh, but if you eliminated all of the uninsured, then the health outcomes would be the same in the two countries. I don't know the answer to that. I suspect that the uninsured do contribute disproportionately to the poor life expectancy, the high infant mortality, the other evidence that we're not getting our money's worth. But I don't know to what degree. It wouldn't explain infant mortality, I don't think, or immunization rates, this kind of thing. Oh, I don't think so. Well, I'm in Canada. I have looked at Europe. Shouldn't I be looking at Europe instead of Canada? I've looked at a number of countries. I don't believe that Canada was ranked by the OECD as what the most
inoffensive.
No, I don't think so. I would be very surprised. The question was, did everybody hear the question? How much of the costs in the United States are prescription drugs, and how much of the health effects or the illness is due to the side effects of prescription drugs? Actually, the U.S. spends less as a percentage of the total on prescription drugs than Canada. That's because we're so expensive in every other way. So there's always a denominator when you look at the numerator and the denominator. I think the U.S. spends about 12% of its healthcare dollar on prescription drugs. Canada, 17%, the last I saw. In fact, in Canada, it's the second most expensive part of the Canadian system after hospitalization, and the cost of prescription drugs is the most rapidly increasing component of the Canadian expenditures. In the U.S., it is maybe the third most expensive, but that's because we spend so much on hospitalization, outpatient care, doctor's fees. So it's relatively less in the United States, but it's too much in both countries. It's way too much in both countries. I didn't talk about the industries that benefit from a private system, but the pharmaceutical industry is certainly one that does. Well, there have been attempts to calculate that. There was an article in the Journal of the American Medical Association some years ago that said 100,000 people die in the hospital in the United States every year because of the side effects of drugs administered appropriately. It wasn't just an accident, but because of the inherent side effects of the drugs in ill people. I think that study could be argued with. I mean, it had some assumptions that make it not, it's hard to reach a figure. So you can't be sure, but probably many, many people, both in hospitals and out of hospitals. We don't know how many. And I see no reason to think that it's more in the United States than it is in Canada. We do take probably some more drugs than you do, but not that much. We're both overdrugged. What do American surveys show about the public attitude toward the healthcare system? I think I mentioned it in my talk. Overwhelming support for a single-payer system. They hate it. Americans hate their system, by and large. They like their doctors. They all say, I like my doctor. But they don't like the system. And the doctors don't either.
I'd like to ask Dr. Romain Gallagher to come up and thank our speaker. Dr. Gallagher is Program Director of the Elder Care and Palliative Care Programs of Providence Health.
Thank you. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Angel. I find myself thinking that if most doctors like the American system and they could live 2.5 years longer, how come they don't come here? Because we have a real shortage. We could use some of them. But I really did enjoy your talk, and I think, yes, our system has problems. I think, for one thing, we have problems with navigation of the system. It's getting incredibly complex. We have problems with technology. But these are some of the things I think we share, is that the more technology there is, the harder it is to decide what to use and when to stop using it. And I'm really pleased to hear you promoting our system, because I think many people have been rather down on our system. But I think that comes the difference between looking at population health versus an individual looking at the health they can get. But I think you've really pointed out that actually we're not doing too bad, that we do need to fund it more. I do wish I could send you across the water to our capital to repeat your talk. And I thank you very much for coming to educate us about it. And we certainly, if you want to live a little longer, move to the north.
It's a wonderful invitation.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Brown. And thank you.